You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 15th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
For the second time in 5 years, a British MP is killed on the job. Germany honours its troops and runs into difficulties with the optics, and one town in New Zealand sacks its long-serving wizard, creating an unhappy medium. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily, in association with Allianz, starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's our Friday in-house daily, and the two Monocle staffers who have recovered most passably from last night's 10th anniversary party are Chiara Ramella and Chris Chermak. They'll discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have Henry Rhys Sheridan's latest letter from New York City. Stay tuned. That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Monocle's culture editor Chiara Ramella and Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak. The Daily has returned to the seating position. As regular listeners will be aware, we did last night's Daily standing up live in front of an audience at the Monocle Media Summit. How was the Media Summit for you both? I will ask you first, Chiara.
I thought it was really interesting. I think as a member of the staff, you don't often get to enjoy a conference fully, but I took a seat in the audience for much of the conference yesterday. I did host a panel, and it's always remarkable, I think, when at the end of an event you genuinely do want to go up to the speakers and tell them how much you enjoyed it and also continue asking questions. And that's, I think, the feeling I was left with after Clarissa Ward's panel. She talked so much about her reporting in Afghanistan, the importance of being a foreign correspondent on the ground. But also I had a really interesting conversation about the future of Newsstand on stage with Christoph Armand and Jeremy Leslie of Mug Culture. And, you know, ultimately, I think it was a great way for us to actually go in depth into topics that we often cover in the magazine. But hearing different perspectives about it just opens up a whole wealth of new perspectives that is really enlightening for me as well.
And Chris, how was it for you?
I think those are a lot of good points. I think it's interesting to do a media summit in a way to speak with fellow journalists rather than sort of what we often do is, you know, talking politics or talk. It's sort of fun to talk about ourselves and what needs to happen within our own industry. And I really was, have to say, struck by not only that the panels were very, very interesting and informative, but just there was a lot of passion, which I think really came through from someone like Clarissa Ward, from someone like Peter York of the BBC, who was sort of defending the importance of public service broadcasting as well. And I just, the passion that was there, I think, was one of the most striking things to me, how much we do care as journalists, and we are trying our best to get this right whenever we can.
Well, let's start with tonight's top story here in the UK, where the MP Sir David Amos has died after being stabbed while carrying out his regular constituency surgery in a church in Leon Sea in Essex. Sir David was 69 and had been a Conservative MP since 1983, representing the Essex seat of Basildon, first of all, and more recently Southend West. Essex police have arrested a man on suspicion of murder. They have stated that they are not looking for anybody else. Chris, as our news editor, you have been following this story. Do we know much more than that at the moment?
To be honest, we don't know a huge amount more than that. We know that he was stabbed multiple times from reports in a church where this constituency surgery was being held. Police have said that they have arrested a 25-year-old man on suspicion of murder, and that person remains in custody. They recovered a knife at the attack. They are not looking for anyone else. So in that sense, they believe they have found that person. Beyond that, at the moment, we don't know that much about all of the circumstances, and certainly we don't know if or what the motivations might have been for this at a constituency surgery. Really, really otherwise, the focus this afternoon has just been on, an outpouring of sort of words about Just shock about the fact that this happened, and then words, of course, about Sir David Amos himself, who he was. Even Boris Johnson has spoken now at this point about his shock, and also just, you know, about a fellow Conservative MP being stabbed in this way. So there's just been a focus really on him, that he was an incredibly kind person. It's quite surprising in that sense too, that this would happen to somebody like Sir David Amos, who just doesn't feel like somebody who he wasn't in any, from everything you read, he wasn't in any particularly strong controversies, if you will. He was just somebody who was quite engaging. He's been a backbencher for so long throughout his career, really, of 40 years. So in that sense, it's just sort of hard to know what exactly would prompt something like this. And that's, I think, also where a lot of the shock is coming from.
Kiara, there may be a lot of bemusement as to the circumstances of his death from abroad. This idea of the constituency surgery, which is something that also is inherited by my country, Australia, from the Westminster tradition, which I do think is in and of itself actually rather lovely, but also an important part of parliamentary democracy. And it is basically the idea that the MP will make time and a regular space for any of their constituents to come and see them about whatever it is they like, pretty much. And we should stress that even if you are a cabinet minister or indeed the prime minister, you are still periodically obliged to go to the place you represent and listen to people complaining to you about potholes and bin collections. I think it's genuinely important. And of course, what is also being talked about now is, are we now content, following the death of Sir David Amos and the death 5 years ago of Joe Cox, to let MPs continue to run what is clearly a risk?
Well, the Commons Speaker has said that they will need to discuss and examine MP security. Whether that will necessarily coincide with the tradition of surgeries not continuing anymore is to be determined. Some people are talking about perhaps increasing security in the form of bodyguards or something like this. But this is not a new problem. I've read reports of other politicians or former politicians who said that they received 50 death threats a week. Mm. And certain people have been incarcerated for very serious death threats to MPs. So this is a problem that's clearly, you know, endemic, and it does exist. I have to say that as an Italian coming to London, I was really surprised by this tradition of openness of MPs. And I really fell in love with it. I mean, personally, I've not in person been to see my local MP. But I do remember walking down the street and seeing this huge sign on the street that said Vicky Foxcroft, MP, and it was just down the road from me, and it looked like a shop, and I was shocked that there would be so much, you know, such a forthcoming attitude to literally having an open door to people to come through, when I think about how completely unapproachable members of the Italian Parliament are. I mean, I was just literally doing some research before coming on this programme, seeing, you know, how easy would it be for me to contact a member of the Italian Parliament, and you Google that and it just shows a generic page of the Italian Parliament saying, oh, you can contact them via email here. It's just not the same. And it doesn't create the same level of belief in democracy. Absolutely. I do think that that is integral. And I think it's very disappointing that the violence and the attacks that happen by people who are disillusioned by democracy, who by doing what they're doing are essentially destroying one of the healthiest ways of maintaining actual contact between the people and their representatives.
Well, this is what I wonder about as well, Chris, because unlike Chiara, I have been to MP surgeries in the UK, not on my own account. I was helping people out who needed help with seeing their MP for various reasons. But what actually strikes me, or what concerns me now, and as Chiara also said quite rightly, the attack on Sir David and the attack on Joe Cox have not happened in isolation. Stephen Timms MP was stabbed in 2010. Andy Pennington, an assistant to Nigel Jones MP, was murdered in 2000. That, for obvious reasons, a lot of people who go to an MP surgery are already quite vulnerable people. They're often undocumented people. They're quite often people who are a bit fearful and tentative about the whole process. If there are metal detectors and special branch and bodyguards there as well, does it deter those people from coming and making their case?
I think that's a good point. I mean, that's exactly the kind of balance that you would be worried about. It is important, I think, for our elected officials to be approachable to the public as much as is possible. I think it does show, I think, that the fact that we have seen more of these cases, as you mentioned here, but also elsewhere. I know in Germany, when I was there, you know, Walter Lübcke was this case from 2019 of a local politician in Hesse who was assassinated by, in that case, a neo-Nazi extremist. But nevertheless, it was similar in this manner of simply somebody who wasn't even, you know, hugely in the public eye, who then still, because he was simply out, was faced with this kind of with this kind of issue. But at the same time, even in Germany, I have to say, you know, I was covering the elections there this time around in September. And I spent time with the Berlin mayoral candidate, who will now be Berlin's mayor, Franziska Giffey. And she was out on the streets campaigning, as you do. I mean, as you're expected to do in a democracy. She was not, yes, she had people around her, but there wasn't necessarily security. She was walking down the streets. She was talking. She was inviting conversation with members of the constituency in Lichtenberg, where I was. And, you know, that struck me in itself, I have to say, because of exactly this one little question in my mind was like, well, is this really safe for her as such an important public official, also former federal minister, to simply be walking the streets of the city? But at the same time, I also felt, well, this is nice. This is important. This is good to see. And she was very engaging with whoever walked up to her. And you do see that in many countries, whether it's a constituency surgery or just campaigning as elected officials. I just think that access is crucial, and it would be very sad to see that go, even if we do need to think perhaps a little bit more about security, maybe having a security guard there, plain clothes, bodyguards, things like that, to just have somewhat more security in this rather polarized environment that we're in is probably necessary, but do it as unobstructively as you possibly can.
Well, let's move along. And it would be wrong, we hope, obviously, to continue to hold modern Germany responsible for the crimes committed by its predecessor state. Nevertheless, eyebrows were arched in a great many quarters earlier this week when the Bundeswehr held a ceremony in Berlin to honour the 90,000-odd German soldiers who served during the West's 20-year intervention in Afghanistan, 59 of whom died there. As part of proceedings, troops staged the Zapfenstreich ceremony, which involved German soldiers marching with torches in front of the Reichstag. There were those, not a few in Germany itself, who wondered if it might nevertheless be a bit soon. Chris, what did you think?
Oh, God, I've been going back and forth on this, to be perfectly honest, throughout today, and we've been discussing it before the show as well. It's a really hard one to discuss in a nuanced manner, I would say. Having lived, you know, and spent a lot of time in Germany as well, the relationship that Germany has to its military is, of course, very fraught. It always has been. It probably always will be. And everyone you feel in Germany, whether it's in the military or politicians you speak to or average citizens, are still very, very conscious of their history. And so I do think that's important to say in a way as background. At the same time, you are slowly seeing the German military take on increasing military roles around the world as countries are expecting them to do. Including Afghanistan was really one of its biggest military interventions since the Second World War. The importance of all that background is to say, so if you're going to have a military role, a certain amount of ceremony, I think, comes with that. You know
it
what I
does.
Mean? I think it should come with that, a certain amount of, you don't want to say patriotism, perhaps, but pride. That's where the debate right now is. And this was, I think, very interesting because it really was, if you will, the first time in a very long time that Germany has had something to have a ceremony about the German military, if you will. As you said, 59 German soldiers died in Afghanistan. It was important to commemorate that. They went with a commemoration that they have been doing for hundreds of years, it should be
said.
Since, you know, so this is not something that is related to Nazi Germany in that sense. And yet, yes, the images, when you look at them, particularly of the torches at night in front of the Reichstag, evoke a different imagery. And so it is It is really tricky. I found the discussion today and looking at German media over the last couple of days interesting because you see this divide. But what strikes me is a lot of centrist politicians from both parties as well, or various parties, did defend this ceremony. Even the Greens, their foreign policy expert, Omid Noripour, who is actually the only African-born MP in the German parliament, said the ceremony was appropriate, dignified, and moving. The FDP on the Free Democrat side also said that it was an appropriate ceremony to be held. Of course, the Veterans Association for the military said that, you know, it is important for an army controlled by a parliament to, we can think of no better place than the seat of parliament to honor the service of the Bundeswehr and the sacrifices of its troops. So it has sparked this whole debate. It's sometimes a shame that it sort of gets lost simply in a case of imagery. And maybe just for that alone, it's worth giving up the imagery. You know what I mean? I really struggle with this personally, but that is one argument to make that this should have been such a solemn occasion. And it is sad that the way that we are talking about it is about the imagery of the torches. You remove that, perhaps it could have been just a solemn ceremony.
I have to say I myself was not wild about the torches. Kiara, I do remember meeting German personnel in Afghanistan in about 2003 and having actually a variation of this conversation with them. And I was genuinely impressed by the earnestness and the thoughtfulness with which they discussed what I remember one of them saying was the unique burden that you carry with you as a German soldier when deployed overseas. They said, like, you know, even in Afghanistan, we know that people have some understanding of the history. And they regarded it, I got the sense that they regarded it as a real challenge to show that we can do this. We can deploy on overseas operations. We are very much not that country and not those people. But they didn't sort of demand to be disassociated from that. They realized we do have work to do here, and they were really keen to do it. I was really, really impressed with how seriously they took it. But is it right, though, do you think, to carry on expecting Germany, Japan, and indeed your country, Italy, to carry on marching on eggshells?
Well, I think that in grand historical terms, it's really not been that long. and I think that we are seeing the consequences of, you know, the behaviours of those dictatorships still today. It really isn't, it really hasn't been that long. And I mean, we will get on to speaking about this shortly when we get on to speaking about Italy and its far-right movements. But those things exist very kind of alive and well in Italy today, for example. So I do think that in this specific case, the issue of whether national pride is possible for countries that have a very unsavory past, and particularly a very unsavory form of national pride, can be slightly divorced from the issue at hand. Because I do think that the symbolism here is, and the optics, as we said, are very powerful. And I do wonder if at some point, symbols that are, or imagery that is not appropriated, but at least inhabited by somebody, does inevitably become linked and almost impossible to disassociate. I mean, I'm thinking about Italy, for example. Fascist imagery, like, you know, the eagle or the wolf or the letters SPQR. Not that I would particularly want to necessarily wear Roman insignia, because I don't feel like I have a particular attachment to ancient Rome myself. But I would never. It still feels slightly uncomfortable when you do see those symbols, even if they aren't perhaps, you know, linked to ancient Rome itself. Similarly, we were talking about today earlier, you know, the swastika itself isn't necessarily a Nazi symbol. It's a pre-existing symbol. Can you divorce it from Nazism now? Impossible, right? And I do think that the imagery from yesterday night, perhaps even because the uniforms that were worn were kind of historical looking, there was definitely a sense of past there. I've seen imagery from earlier on the same day when the uniforms were much more modern looking. And, you know, I think there are certain things that you can do to modernize the traditions in a way that perhaps doesn't necessarily replicate the same imagery.
Kiara and Chris, thank you both for the moment. It's time now for our letter from New York City. And this week, Henry Rees Sheridan looks at a particularly heated debate over public education.
Last Friday, 3 months before the end of his final term as mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio announced one of his most controversial policies. He wants to phase out the gifted and talented program in the city's public schools.
We're going to be ending something that I think was a mistake all along, a single test for four-year-olds that determines so much of their future.
The gifted and talented program is for children who score highly on an optional test administered as young as age four.
Hi, I'm Leanne, and I'm here to talk to you about the New York State Gifted and Talented Exam. The New York City Gifted and Talented Exam is comprised of two parts, NANAT and OLSAT. The NANAT 2 is the nonverbal portion of the exam.
The top scorers become eligible for educational tracks with a more challenging curriculum. This can have a major impact on a child's prospects, as it puts them in an advantageous position to gain access to the best high schools and colleges. This system is highly controversial. Many simply object to administering such high-stakes academic tests to children under the age of five. But the debate over New York's gifted and talented program wouldn't be so emotionally intense if the concern was purely pedagogical. It's so heated in large part because of the way the tests interact with the complex racial dynamics of the city.
In what could be one of his last major decisions in office, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced today the city will do away with its gifted and talented program for elementary schools. Students will instead take part in something called Brilliant NYC, which will allow students ages 8 and up to learn through an accelerated learning format without separating them into a different class. Opponents of gifted and talented programs have argued that the test given to kindergarten students discriminates against those with fewer resources and doesn't measure true aptitude. The mayor has long faced criticism for not doing more.
With 1.1 million students, New York City's public school system is the biggest in the country. It's also the most racially segregated. When de Blasio came into office, it was with the promise to improve racial equality in the school system. To this end, he convened a panel to look into the most effective ways to desegregate schools, the School Diversity Advisory Group.
We don't have an admissions policy based on a single test. Those are the things that exclude kids because they're poor. New York likes to think of itself as a cutting-edge city that's leading the country. We absolutely are not on public education.
In 2019, the panel came out with a bombshell recommendation. New York's gifted and talented program should be scrapped. It privileges students from certain backgrounds over others and is a driver of segregation in schools. Having convened the School Diversity Advisory Group, de Blasio distanced himself from its recommendations. One of his spokespeople explicitly stated there would be no changes to the gifted and talented program that year. This is because de Blasio knew that to do away with the program would invite the wrath of a fearful and well-organized pressure group, parents whose children benefited from it.
There's sort of this sense, I think, in New York that you have to take it just to even be remotely competitive.
To say we're going to eliminate programs that have been very successful and we're going to reimagine in the seventh year of my mayoralty some other vague plans is the height of disrespect to parents.
Let's revisit whether or not there needs to be a distinction at all, as opposed to raising up the overall level of curriculum pointed at all kids.
Many of these parents are middle and high income white New Yorkers, and if the objections to scrapping the gifted and talented program was coming exclusively from them, it would be easy to dismiss their concern as a thinly veiled segregationist impulse. But the picture is more complicated than that. Some of the most vocal opponents to scrapping the gifted and talented program are low and middle income Asian American parents. This is a group whose children do particularly well within it. In 2019 to 2020, Asian students made up 43% of those in the gifted and talented program, despite comprising only 20% of the kindergarten population as a whole. The Gifted and Talented program is considered by many in the Asian American community to be a major vehicle of progression for students from low-income backgrounds. Of course, a full spectrum of views about the program exist among Asian Americans. Many Asian groups advocate for reform of the education system, including the Gifted and Talented program. But it's impossible to understand the debate in the fullness of its complexity without accounting for Asian Americans' special relationship to the program. The fierceness of the response from these parents and the unpleasant optics of being seen to target a heavily immigrant non-white population might explain why de Blasio has waited until his very last days as mayor to announce that the Gifted and Talented program is being phased out. Responsibility for overseeing the execution of the policy will fall almost entirely on his successor. And his successor will almost certainly be Eric Adams. Adams has a different stance towards the Gifted and Talented program than de Blasio. He wants to keep the program but expand it in low-income neighborhoods with higher proportions of Black and Latino students. Whatever transpires, the buck has been passed again when it comes to actually implementing a strategy to desegregate New York City's public schools. No one in principle wants segregated schools in this kaleidoscopically diverse city. But the truth is that the political will to make the tough decisions that would change the system just isn't there. It's one of New York's great tragedies.
And that was Henry Rhys Sheridan in New York City. This is the Monocle Daily. We'll have more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marie Doha Besancenot is the brand and communication director of Allianz France. Marie Doha Besancenot, it's great to talk with you. What are some of the programmes Allianz is spearheading internally with regard to a sustainable future?
We provide attractive prices to ensure hybrid cars, or we encourage our customers to go for secondhand spare parts when they need a car repair. And we offer special insurance for those who drive very little, where they pay only according to the number of kilometers they've actually driven. So we're there to accompany those virtuous behaviors of those who really want to make a difference. Also, one of the programs we're very proud of is we are bringing our 2,000 tied agents along with us because they are part of the adventure. So we have worked with a national certification organization to produce a CSR certification, so corporate social responsibility certification, for the agencies who volunteer to earn that label. And it makes such a difference when a tied agent is personally involved in making his agency sustainable and advertises his care for the environment with a sticker on his shop window or something else. It's the right signal for our customers, and they know that they will find someone inside with whom they can talk sustainable products.
Marie Doha Besancenot, brand and communication director of Allianz France, on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Chiara Ramella and Chris Chermak. To Italy now, where as of today, the Green Pass has become mandatory for all workplaces. The Green Pass indicates whether the bearer has been vaccinated against COVID-19, had COVID-19, or tested negative for COVID-19, and is therefore probably no great danger to others. But roughly 3 million Italian workers are still believed to be unjabbed, and not a few of them have experienced expressed their displeasure with the Green Pass regime by striking and or otherwise protesting. In one of the bigger gatherings of malcontents, around 6,000 picketed outside the docks in Trieste. Chiara, Italy is where you are from, as we may have discussed once or twice previously. This is a notably hardcore approach Italy has taken here. Why is Italy going in this hard? Is it because Italy is still to some extent, haunted by having caught the worst of the first wave of COVID-19 early on?
I think there are a number of different reasons, and sitting from this perspective point of very liberal, and by liberal I mean kind of neoliberal England.
You mean just disorganised and chaotic?
No, but I mean, people in Italy are absolutely flabbergasted at the amount of freedom that people have in England right now, and they think it's irresponsible and essentially driven by a kind of neo-capitalist attitude that favours personal freedoms over everything else. That's not necessarily the case in Italy. Traditionally, the state is a much bigger a presence, for better or worse, in Italian affairs. And that does mean a lot of bureaucracy in many cases, but it does also mean a more felt state presence. And in that respect, the approach to COVID has been quite strict throughout, to be completely honest with you. Going to southern European Mediterranean countries right now will shock a lot of people coming perhaps from the US or from Northern Europe, because it is still very strict. Italy is remarkably strict with this measure, perhaps the strictest around the world, particularly when it comes to work. And just to give you a bit of perspective, so the issue is that either you're vaccinated or you have a recent test that proves that you're negative. But the problem lies in whether the companies, because it's not just public sector, so private sector, so any kind of work, so that the companies are willing to pay for the tests that you have to take in order to go to work or not. And the vast majority of companies are saying no. So that would come up to a cost of essentially roughly 200 euros a month for a worker to be able to go to work. But then the companies and a large part of the population is saying, we're not willing to pay for your choice. You're the one who's choosing to do this to the community. I guess the problem then there becomes, if you're not going to make the vaccination legally necessary, if it's not illegal to be not vaccinated, then this is affecting very much my ability to survive. It's if you do not go to work because you don't have a green pass, your pay will be suspended, you'll be sent home, you cannot be fired, but all the same, the pay is not coming in, and you can't imagine for this to be a very happy ending. So there is very much a very polarized situation in Italy, where there are people who consider this an absolute breach of freedom, and there are people who think that the collective shouldn't bear the economical cost of somebody else's decision.
I do want to ask about the people demonstrating. This is something we did allude to earlier. Is there, because we have seen variations of this theme elsewhere in the world, is there a significant overlap in Italy between the anti-vax tendency and the proper hardcore far-right tendency?
I think that that's the largely assumption, and certainly if you looked at the demonstrations that took place last weekend to be precise, that those had a clear kind of neo-fascist tendency. I mean, what happened was that a demonstration in Rome essentially ended in an invasion of the local trade union, the CGIL office in Rome, and that was led by three very well-known members of Forza Nuova, which is a clearly neo-fascist association that many people have advocated for the closure of, and yet it still persists, and we can go on to talk about why this is actually allowed. Since then, actually, certain members of, more communist-leaning parties have actually demonstrated in front of CGIL offices as well. So there has been a kind of a counter-protest also about the Green Pass. So you have seen kind of cross-party protests around the issue of Green Pass. But I would say that most of the political voices that are being critical of the Green Pass, in terms of also more civil political conversation, are coming from the right now.
Chris, is this something we are still seeing about across Europe, the anti-vax tendency either being manipulated by or manipulating the crankier tendencies of politics?
Well, yes, I think obviously not just in Europe, also being in the U.S. where it's even more polarized when I was visiting there. And also interesting just in the sense that the U.S. is perhaps, although it doesn't have the same tradition that you were talking about, Chiara, of a sort of more open government intervention, if you will, yet still the U.S. has also been perhaps one of the strictest in the world by not quite saying that you have to, in order, not the government mandating that you have to be employed, if you're employed, you have to be vaccinated, but requiring companies essentially to take that lead and requiring companies to ensure that their employees are vaccinated and issuing these vaccine mandates. So it is something we're seeing in different places. And to your point about how that affects the sort of discussion, anti-vaxxers, I feel like I've gone personally also in some ways back and forth in my own views on this, I have to say, in part because at some point you reach a stage where they're just, you are still facing millions of people who are not vaccinated. Are they going to be vaccinated because you forced them to, or are they going to withdraw from society completely as a result of being forced to do something they don't want to do? I'm starting to, in that sense, also when we talk about these links between the far right, anti-vax movements, people who are skeptical of vaccination, I think we have to sometimes be careful not to lump them all into one boat, if you will, because I think there are those who might be convinced if we reached out in some other form to get vaccinated, if it wasn't necessarily always quite as aggressive in the stance that we take. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, I think also many of these people then are sort of pulled into a far right orbit as a result of the more aggressive measures we are taking. So I think it is an incredibly complex situation right now. But I do worry because there's just because of the sheer amount of people who are not vaccinated yet. And are they really going to move as a result of mandates? I'm just not sure.
Well, we will keep an eye on how the Green Pass works. But and finally, fabulous sound effect there, the reasons for which will shortly become clear. We are going to New Zealand, where the city of Christchurch has said, see ya later, see ya later, to its official wizard. You see why, where I was going with that. After 23 years of service, still he had a good spell here all week, try the veal, etc. This is a thing which has happened. We are not making it up. And for further elucidation, we are also joined now by Monocle24's New Zealand desk chief, David Stevens. See, David, this was quite interesting to me as an Australian, because I assumed that the Wizard of New Zealand was the person who actually ran the place. But I looked into this and I discovered you've got an actual Prime Minister, which is nice. But the city of Christchurch, it turns out, has been retaining, at ratepayers' expense, an actual wizard. So my question to you is basically, what the what?
Well, may I say first, not a sound effect, Andrew. That was me appearing in the studio by magic. Do you know what? I didn't have a lot of knowledge about this man before about an hour ago.
Okay, well, now you're here, but bluff furiously.
But I wanted to get ahead of the insults, and clearly you didn't even let me get there. This man is not only not from New Zealand, he was born in London. Also, the first people...
So are we going to get together to blame the Poms for this?
Well, let me go on. The first people to employ him, albeit unpaid, as a cosmologist, was the University of Melbourne. So you've just encouraged him. Your people have just encouraged him.
Well, when you say your people, I mean, Melbourne is in Victoria. They're all quite strange down there. David, this fellow, this wizard, mm-hmm. I'm not sure how you address a wizard.
The wizard, in fact, his official wizard. Name on his passport.
Is it Your Excellency or Your Wizardness or whatever it is?
It's QSM, so he's got the title.
He has trousered $368,000 New Zealand dollars, which again was news to me because I sort of thought beaver pelts were still the currency. But anyway, $368,000 over the last 23 years. Is that money well spent, do you think the average Kiwi voter thinks?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen New Zealand's soft power rankings, at least on the pages of Monocle, go up in the last, I don't know, 10 years. So I think so. And you've also got to think of the things that he's prevented, the things we never knew could have happened, and subsequently didn't. So all those wildfires that could have, you know, destroyed the entire country, they didn't happen. And maybe that's the wizards doing.
There was an earthquake.
There was an earthquake, but there could have been more earthquakes, Andrew.
So basically that's your line. You're not blaming him for failing to prevent the earthquake. You're saying that he might have prevented further earthquakes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's an interpretation. Let's bring our Agog panel back in. Kiara, where are you on the propriety of public money being used to retain wizards?
Well, wizards per se, I don't have a problem with.
Okay,
we'll get onto
good,
this.
Excellent.
But I think let's get specifically more about the story of this specific wizard, the Wizard of Christchurch.
Must we?
Because it does happen, it transpires that part of the reason why he was sacked is because he did say some really quite unsavoury things about women.
This is true.
Which we won't repeat on air because I'm not the kind of person who will do that. But then I do wonder, was he sacked because he was a sexist wizard, or was he sacked because people no longer want wizards? So
was he sacked because somebody realised, sorry, we've spent $368,000 on what now?
No, but it's interesting. The City of Christchurch wants to present a more modern and diverse image of itself, and you guess an 88-year-old wizard is not exactly either of those two things.
So they're going to what, replace him with an astrologer or something?
No, they said the wizard no longer fit the vibes of the city, which I guess is a city hall official parlance. But yeah, I wonder if they're just on the hunt for maybe a 20-year-old wizard to take over the post and not say any sexist things.
David, would you like to throw your hat, by which obviously pointy, into the ring?
I would like to throw my hat as far out of the ring as I possibly can.
Chris, have you ever known the like in your upbringing amid the stolid, sensible hinterlands of Middle Europa? do they go much in for this sort of thing?
Oh, my God. Not that I can particularly think of, I have to say. I found this incredibly unique, although what I have to say I found interesting about this story, I will say, was if we're going back to the origins, I just found it amazing that it was actually the Prime Minister of New Zealand who initially offered this appointment to the wizard on sort of the public's behalf. It was, this is democracy in action, what we're actually talking about here.
I mean, if you are Prime Minister of New Zealand, you've got to come up with something to pass the day. I mean, it's just like, yeah.
There's an official letterhead invite for him to become Wizard of New Zealand from the Prime Minister of New Zealand. I mean, you can't make that up.
I think stating something like, we can't just not use your services to help the people of New Zealand, so we're going to have to take, like it had to be done. There was no other option.
There was no choice.
Mostly, I wonder whether it has been that much of a soft power coup, because we're all here discussing the Wizard of Christchurch. How many of us had heard of the Wizard of Christchurch before? So was the money worth it from a soft power point of view? That's an open question.
I don't know, $383,000 over 23 years, and your reward for that is you get fun made of you for 5 minutes on Monocle 24. Is that what our ads are going at? on that, in fact, self-congratulatory, I see it's Friday, I cannot say the word congratulatory. On that self-congratulatory note, all this week, our listeners will be keenly aware by now, we have been celebrating 10 years on air of this very radio station. A decade on from its debut, the always-on radio station that is Monocle 24 has become a much-loved and influential, if we say so ourselves, broadcaster. Here's Monocle's head of radio, Tom Edwards, to talk us through how we did it.
Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Marcus Hippie.
Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller.
Picture the scene. It's a summer's day in London in 2011. A group of editors are deep in conversation about growing the burgeoning media brand that they've built, and growing it in a more imaginative way than manipulating a magazine until it fits a screen but loses its luster. One of their number points out that the team's already been making a whip-smart weekly podcast for the past couple of years. It follows, he suggests, warming to his theme, that they go right ahead and launch a full-service, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day radio station before the year is out. After all, could anything amplify the voice of a confident brand better than radio? Fast forward to later that same year, a smart suite of studios is receiving its finishing touches. The magazine crew's been bolstered by a host of hungry Monocle 24 recruits, and a fairly ambitious launch date, 17th of October, is heavily ringed in red in diaries and on calendars. The radio dream is becoming a reality.
Monocle 24, our new round-the-clock audio service, premieres bright and early October 17th. Listen in for live discussions with our editors, world news, fresh reports from the worlds of business, design and culture, and a global mix of music to see you through night and day.
The launch brief was to deliver the authority and smarts of public service broadcasting with a friendlier, more curious and conversational tone. Mission Monocle 24 was accomplished that autumn, albeit with some hair-raising moments, many sleepless nights, and a litany of nerve-jangling technical leaps of faith along the way. It was a steep learning curve, but at the summit was audio gold. At the time, Monocle's editorial director, Tyler Brulé, explained that radio was still the most intimate medium in an ever-expanding buffet of choice. And in the decades since, we're proud of the way that we've refined the recipe. Today, there's something for every palate, with long-running news shows, such as The Globalist, The Briefing and The Daily, and magazine programmes, including The Urbanist and The Entrepreneurs, joined by a steady stream of exciting and innovative additions.
Actually, in number five, we're going to start with an interesting trend. Before we listen to that, so basically, you know, gospel music is very big in South Africa.
Okay.
But there's, but I mean, if you're a gospel singer.
In 2011, the podcast landscape was inchoate, and few could have foreseen the astonishing growth of the sector in the decade ahead. Monocle 24's blend of radio's linear discipline and structure with podcasting's more Catholic pick-a-mix approach is undoubtedly one of the secrets to its success. Another is the way that it brought together the metabolism and intensity of the traditional newsroom with the journalistic rigour and gentle authority that is Monocle's print signature. There have been some amazing milestones. We've launched more than 60 new shows and podcasts and have broadcast nearly 88,000 hours of audio.
He said, you know, I want a new generation airport. I want you to challenge everything.
Fabiana, I would like to start saying that actually, for those who don't know, Brazil is the second biggest producer of biscuits in the world, just behind the US. Why are we only the 33rd country among biscuits exporters?
When I started Tom's, I just saw it as a small project. I didn't think we would make any money. I wanted to help some kids get shoes in Argentina that I met while traveling. And then, of course,
Monocle 24 produces more programs and podcasts every week than any comparable media house. We've broadcast to the world from a radio-equipped bureau network in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich, Toronto, New York, and Los Angeles. We've aired dispatches from Monocle's global correspondents in scores of cities across five continents. And we've taken our show on the road with outside broadcasts from the snowy mountaintops of St. Moritz to the sun-kissed seaside of Sydney and pretty much everywhere else in between.
Kalimera, good morning and a very warm welcome to the latest and most ambitious yet edition of the Monocle Quality of Life Conference here in Athens. And to start the day,
as well as the best coverage of entrepreneurship, culture, design, media and urbanism, our hugely talented news team has consistently delivered award-winning coverage, reportage and analysis to our international listeners.
We've worked with suppliers over the last 30 years. We have some suppliers that we've...
Leo, Manu, what is... Welcome to the programme. Macan and Toucanopolis. What is that like in your head? Is it the ultimate holiday destination? It doesn't sound like it's a dystopian vision of the future. It sounds like something wet and wild.
That's it. This is our dream.
Monocle 24 now has an unrivaled pool of experts on hand to make sense of turbulent times. The coronavirus crisis might have created a more or less captive audience, but the fact that discerning listeners came to Monocle 24 in unprecedented numbers speaks volumes for the quality of the fair.
As this edition of The Foreign Desk goes to air, the coronavirus, COVID-19, has been detected in more than 50 countries. What have we learned so far about what works and what doesn't? How wary should nations and businesses be of overreaction? This is The Foreign Desk.
Central to the success of Monocle 24, along with the unparalleled editorial offering, has been the relationship that the station has built with its partners. These comprise some particularly far-sighted international companies, a family of premium brands that, right from the start, recognised the importance of great storytelling, setting the right tone, and the relentless pursuit of opportunity. The final piece of the puzzle is, of course, the most important of all, many of whom have been with us from the very first second on air. Where are we taking them next? Well, you'll have to stay tuned to find out. Be assured that we're as passionate as ever about continuing a global conversation, delving into more long-form storytelling, expanding our reach and playing to ever bigger audiences, all while cementing our hard-won reputation for the best in news, features, documentaries and smart narratives. Here's to the next 10 years.
That was Monocle's head of radio, Tom Edwards, and that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Chiara Ramella and Chris Chermak. Also, of course, to our New Zealand desk chief, David Stevens. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific weekend.